You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Today we are joined by the author of The Red Dreaded Spindle, Sasha Ravitch, who has in recent years pioneered a field she refers to as stellar and deep space witchcraft, a branch of magic dedicated to the sorcerous spirit work of outer space and the various deep space objects, stars and spirits therein. In her pamphlet, which is part of Hadean's Guides to the Underworld series, Sasha explores the depths of myth that intersect with one of the most misunderstood regions of the night sky, that of Scorpius, and the fearsome and mysterious fixed stars from which it is composed. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Sasha to the Hadean Press podcast. Hi, Sasha. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Matt. It's a real pleasure.
I'm very pleased to have you on because I think there is a really amazing conversation to be had about your particular take on sorcery and magic, especially in regards to the way you approach mythology and the night sky. There is a lot of crossover with many of the same subjects I'm personally interested in. Could you describe something of yourself for the audience, your background, and what brought you to magic?
Oh, Lord, this is always my least favorite part of any discussion, because it's so hard to try and talk about oneself in ways that doesn't feel like it begins to interrupt or get in the way of the work they're discussing. But most people know me for the work I do within the world of stellar witchcraft, as I've called it, stellar or deep space witchcraft, pulling from many disparate threads, weaving together into one sort of overarching tapestry involving my backgrounds in literature, like transgressive literature, cosmic horror, sexual transgression, my background in social work, in psychoanalysis, my background in traditional and Hellenistic astrology, my background in different types of folkloric magics, all of these things coming into one discombobulated and perhaps slightly misshapen orb that comprises my career at this point. But what brought me to magic is actually a much simpler, I would presume, maybe to me, maybe not to everyone, much simpler journey, which has to do with just one book that I was given when I was about 10 years old by my mother, which was a fortune-telling book. My family, in part, is Roma, and so this was just a cute way that my mom wanted to make a hint at or nod to something. And that was a big, big entryway for me. I mean, it also was a big entryway to getting bullied a lot in middle school. But I mean, what isn't a good way to get bullied in middle school at that point? But that, in addition to a really fanatic passion and hunger for fantasy and science fiction novels.
Okay, so it was science fiction that was one of your major influences?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to clarify that. It's a particular type of science fiction. Science fiction, cosmic horror, right? I wasn't really into like space opera or like adventure science fiction I wasn't particularly drawn to, though I grew like a great appreciation for them over time, especially into my adulthood. I was never really captured by the Star Treks or the Battlestar Galacticas or the Star Wars ideas and franchises. I was really into the cosmic horror that there was like something deeply unsettling and terrible out there that was staring at us and stalking us, or was going to come down to Earth and interact or engage with us in some way. Those were the things that really spoke to me. So I was really obsessed with Clive Barker, Algernon Blackwood, H.P. Lovecraft, these kind of folks with that worked in the region of perhaps the fallible smallness of man's mind and the insurmountable vastness of what awaits us out there. So those were hugely, hugely shaping. I remember being about 13 and reading Stephen King's Dreamcatcher, which is one of his more like alien-based stories, and having just an unreal, visceral, somatic, like embodied experience to it. I mean, I couldn't sleep after I read it. It changed the way I saw the world. This I don't want to like spoiler this book that's been out for like, you know, like 30 years, 40 years now, but there's a I think an experience that's communicated within it that for spirit workers, witches, sorcerers, is not so unfamiliar to us, which is that moment of communication, of conversation with something outside of you, but inside of you in that moment. And I think those were moments that I found within the milieu of literature, within the milieu of speculative fiction, right? That began to sow particular seeds that would bloom and blossom when I was able to get my hands on more occult content as I grew older.
Yeah, I'm a massive fan of cosmic horror as well. It's very inspiring.
Oh, good.
So you say that this type of magic that you were pioneering isn't specifically astrological magic, but instead stellar witchcraft. Another phrase I've seen used a lot in regards to your work is astrolatry. What is it that distinguishes this from other forms of magic?
These are really great questions. And I love to clarify specifically that what I am doing is not astrological magic. It's magic with names that come up in astrology. So I think a lot of people sort of maybe want to group it into that. But astrological magic is actually a very, at this point, right? There's a lot of contemporary conjecture around this, which I'm not going to participate in. But it is pretty established that astrological magic is a sorceress and magical praxis involving talismanic image magic, with the often end goal of creating a astrological talisman. And there are very particular, very scientific almost rules about how that is done based on particular grimoire workings. So I wanted to really distinguish that this is not, in fact, what I am doing, and therefore disabuse anyone of thinking that some of those rules and ways of engaging could be superimposed onto this. This is very much a witchcraft, right? This is very much a blood and starlight and hissing and writhing and vaguely possessory work. That it is, I use stellar there specifically because I'm not often, though I recently taught a class on like a planetary witchcraft approach. But I'm not often looking at planetary bodies. I'm more interested in what is deep space, what are nebulas, galaxies, corpse stars, etc., and ways that we can work with the various spirits which inhabit those places in workings of witchcraft, which over time reshape us into their own image more and more, right? I often rely a lot, too heavily, to a certain point where it's like a joke now amongst my friends and my mentees and my clients. I rely really heavily on Hellraiser related language a lot of times when I'm describing stellar witchcraft and the Cenobite Leviathan Labyrinth trifecta process for stars, their spirits, their priests, etc. But astrology is a it is a much more engageable, tangible, but devotional, theurgical, thaumaturgical approach to the firmamental practice, right? Astrology is It literally means the worship of like stars or planets. So we're looking at something that is accompanying a lot less malefic fallout, a lot less initiatory ordeal, a lot less of, well, what witchcraft brings with it and becoming increasingly other, right? Brings with it inherently all of that, which you find in different traditional and folkloric witchcraft practices, can also be found in stellar witchcraft as far as the night surgeon operation of the spirit body into something other. Astrology, however, is imagining oneself as a humble devotee or polis priest of the neighboring, like of the neighboring cultists, right? Whichever particular star or constellation or nebulae or whatever draws one closer to it. So someone might have one for, say, Andromeda, or maybe not even Andromeda, but Mirash, the star in Andromeda, and they will devote themselves to that star, that constellation. And this is a practice I really encourage that people engage with prior to leaping into the stellar witchcraft pool, because it creates a relational rapport. It creates some safety, actually, too. And it allows what we see the benefit, right, of devotional practices to do, which is imbue someone with a lot of times the in this particular regard, the stellar light or the benediction of the protection of a particular constellation or star, so that when they begin to engage with some of the more experimental work, it isn't quite as, well, you know, what you end up seeing happen in cosmic horror, right?
Yeah, we wouldn't want to go completely insane.
We're not all trying to go that color out of space route.
So for instance, you're not necessarily dealing with the spirits of the earth that you're conjuring, but instead directly going to the stars.
Yes. Yes, it is. I'm not hesitating because there isn't truth to what was just said. I hesitate because I always want to be very conscious of using terminology that has such long-standing histories of very particular use and application. Part of that is because a lot of what I'm doing is figuring out things along the way. There's a big experimental factor to what I'm doing. And I try to be very mindful about the ways in which I borrow from, and, you know, of course I'm borrowing from other traditions. You know, what is witchcraft? If it's not a cannibalization, right, of pre-existing techne and episteme. But I try to be really mindful of not borrowing in ways that I can't fully justify. There is both an evocational and invocational component. The goal is essentially not just to call the quote unquote spirits, but to call them also as much into the body, into the flesh, in at least a somewhat possessory nature, as it is to call them, say, into the room, right? Into the circle, etc. So there's a little bit of both there, yes, in ways that not always convinced is being done in astrological magic in the same way, though I am sure there are astrological magicians that, whether or not they are endeavoring to, have some component of this happening for them. But I avoid a lot of the language in particular that has been associated with grimoires or with ceremonial and ritual sorceries and magics.
So we could say that you're really pioneering something new here.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little audacious or presumptuous for me to put an emphasis on a newness that I haven't earned yet, right? Like, again, this is still in the experimental, fumbling about in the dark, turning on flashlights when I have moments where I can. And there are incredible people that have explored, I think, a lot of this that I'll never know, that never wrote anything, that were doing this independently. But for me, it has been important to try and create a lexicon of language that is from within the system that I am also working within each day, too. So, for instance, I speak a lot. I lecture on it, and I'm currently finishing writing a book with my amazing collaborator, Meg, on Constellation Hydra. That is my stellar witchcraft mother. That is the mother of that of the practice that I'm pioneering. And within that, there's terminology that I use, right? Like the Red Kingdom, or the Red Appetite, or the Red River, or the Red Queen. All these different pieces of jargon that allow themselves to communicate, sign and signify from within their own self-referential pattern, which means that I don't have to rely upon an audience that is going to be able to pull from the this from Sabbatic craft as easily as they can, from the Petite d'Albert as easily as they can, from the Picatrix, et cetera, right? I want folks to not who have not had the time or the resources made available to pull from all these disparate places to be able to work sort of a system from its side inside itself.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Health. Does that make sense?
Yeah, perfectly. You've created something incredibly powerful, I think, with this little pamphlet, The Red
Oh, thank
Dreaded
you.
Spindle. And I think it's absolutely bristling with energy and potential. Could you describe something of its inception or your inspiration for writing it?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. First of all, it's really funny because I was having a conversation sort of about this process with my extremely wonderful buddy Cadmus last night, where he was talking about how he's able to just write and write and write in this steady way for long periods of time. And I was kvetching essentially about how I'm not the same. I get hit by the lightning rod of a thing that has to move through me, and then I'm on fire and I do nothing other than get that out of me. And then there's a lot of fallow time, right? And I wish dearly to be someone that trudges along each day, toiling more and more. But it really is one of those, and this one in particular came through me. I wrote it in, I think, about 8 hours. And I, of course, went back to like quote the direct quotes, right, that I'm using in there. I didn't just have that on hand. But the body of the original content and the structure of the introductory section, all those things just came through. They were just delivered. And that's what it feels like for me. The inspiration, I think, had been brewing for a while. A lot of that having to do with the fact that I was at this, I noticed this, and I'm sure a lot of consulting astrologers or diviners, especially diviners that work with systems of divination with particular signs or symbols that can repeat, whether that's like a cardamantic or geomantic divinatory process, where you'll go through waves of clients, right, that you meet with that all are seemingly to carry a really heavy imprint or mark with them. And I was just getting stinger star after stinger star, mula nakshatra after mula nakshatra kind of individual over and over again. And so I was doing a lot of scrying into these particular stars and the spirits associated with them for these clients. So I had the benefit of being able to start really applying my personal working theory at the time, which was that there's a remarkable diversity in the way that spirits will present themselves, especially firmamental and stellar or deep space spirits. There do tend to be, as there are in all things, patterns if we are eager enough to, or neurotic in my case, enough to seek them out, right? And I just started noticing the patterns that I speak about in this pamphlet over and over again to a point where I was having one of those like Charlie Kelly from Always Sunny, like the meme of him, the Pepe Silvia smoking the cigarette, you know, next to the all the maps and of the red string. That sort of oh my God, it's all coming together, and I all these connections, and it's just happening over and over again. And I was like talking about it in the. And I had to write it out essentially because my friends asked me to stop talking about it all the time and just write the thing instead of just having to talk to them about like how cool and interesting and weird and how obsessed I was with these overlapping synchronicities and how effectual it felt. And that's where especially some of the, I don't want to name anything too much for the folks that haven't had a chance to read it. But a lot of the stuff that you see for the meat, right, of that second half came from those. And when I really do believe that when something or when spirits are ready for something to be communicated on their behalf to others, you feel it and you know, right? And that's not to put any kind of import on being like, oh, they wanted me to share this or anything. I'm not trying to purport that really obnoxious kind of ego branding, but I knew that it had to be written, and when, or just so that it would stop bothering me. And then when I shared it for the first time, a rough draft, much smaller version for the Execration episode of Speakeasy of the Dead, the Fancy Necromancer Salon hosted by Jesse Hathaway Diaz and Dr. Alexander Cummins. And I got so many emails after from so many people being like, I don't know what that was. I didn't even understand half of it, but I felt whatever you were saying and keep going in that direction. And so I was like, okay, I'm just going to do it. And if it resonates with no one and no one finds it interesting, whatever. But I've been really, 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 really many more reallys moved and affirmed and humbled by how much of a response it did receive.
So except for, of course, being moved by the spirits to produce this specifically, do you have any other affinity or connection with Scorpius, which led you in this way?
You know, I have, it's funny because I have a strong relationship with Antares natally. But I don't have, by any of the systems that I use for discernment, whether it's Perinatalanta, so Fixars by Perrins, or whether it's by a classical projected ecliptic conjunction, none of those with these particular stars. What's interesting about these particular stars too is they also happen to host the galactic center, our particular galaxy's own, right, black hole. Which is very interesting. And I have my Saturn right there. So, and it's my first house. So I do have a little bit of my own, I think maybe window into this area, but I'm just a person who is surrounded, by folks with a strong relationship with this particular area of the sky. So it was one of those more cartographic or like case study based things. So I do have a relationship with Scorpius. Now, obviously, after doing this work, I have a relationship with Acumen and Achilleus as well, because I will never publish or write that I haven't done myself and seen efficacy around. It just, for me, it's like an ethical boundary I have of not wanting to put anything out there that one isn't going to work, at least for me. You know, it may not work for everyone, but if it also doesn't work for the person who's writing it, then that's a problem. And that I wanted to make sure didn't have, I mean, again, you can't mitigate all negative consequences from doing witchcraft. There's initiatory upheavals that come with anything, but ultimately an outcome of greater empowerment, greater confidence, greater freedom, greater whatever you're getting from whatever the right is. So I have more of a relationship now than I had to begin with, which is interesting because a lot of the other constellations and stars I'm in deep relationship with, I do have stronger inherent natal or pre-existing relationships with.
So I also know that you're a big fan of Saturn and and have explored a great deal about the outer planet as more than just a simple malefic archetype. Is there anything that you'd like to tell the audience about this possibly most misunderstood of planets?
So I'm glad you brought this up, because for about 2.5 years of my life, for a whole Saturn cycle, I was in a, to be honest, it was an obsession with Saturn, because I was going through, it was like the beginning of COVID. I was going through a whole world of sort of traumatic acclimation and response to all the life shifts. I had just moved across the country for the first time in my life. Things were just not panning out the way I had hoped or expected them to be. And I realized that in many ways I had been living a life of like unprecedented artifice and artificiality and inauthenticity. And it took a lot of pretty profound life-changing circumstances and experiences facilitated by both really intense, direct astrological transits that I won't specify, but were beyond the Saturn return I found in how challenging they were. And a big come to, instead of Jesus, like Saturn moment, to realize the ways in which I had been incarcerating myself in my own expectations of who I had to be that were no longer relevant to who I was, right? And I credit in many ways, I went through a year long daily devotional to Saturn. So I did bigger things on Saturn's night and Saturn's day, but I did invocational prayers, made offerings during his hour every single day, during the first Saturn hour of the day or the last, depending on what my work schedule was like. I was not fun to be around, Matt. No one like me. Everyone was like, when's party girl Sasha coming back? When's funny, happy Sasha that loves the Vanga boys coming back? Like, when's all like this person that we all like, who is this woman walking around the house in a white cotton nightgown, like a Charles Dickens character listening to like the same opera aria on repeat with like haunted looking eyes? It was that for quite a while. But it took me hitting a sort of personal identity rock bottom, right? To actually be able to look around and say, oh, but who am I? Like, who have I been pretending to be because of what other people wanted or other people liked or got me things that were felt nice, right? When I had no opportunity to perform like that anymore, I had to actually have a conversation about what was underneath. And it wasn't this thing that other people were attached to. There was a lot more gravitas. There was a lot more intensity. There was a lot more roaming around the house in an oversized, you know, white cotton nightgown, listening to opera arias on repeat there, you know, as much as there was like fun at the party person. Over time and by request by the people in my life, I have moved out of that. And it was necessary. It was necessary too, because, well, Saturn is an inevitable and a tremendous medicine in many ways, right? The goal is to never stay in that space. Especially once we have done the deconstructing, we must start to build, right? That's as much Saturn as anything else, right? As much as we saw that world shattering upheaval of Saturn in Aquarius, you know, for a lot of people with this was COVID, right? And like that first decan of Aquarius with Saturn there, Austin Coppock talks about this too, right? Is this need for the mad scientist to go away into the wood, the craftsperson to be isolated in the forest so that they can be uninterrupted by society, by mores, by the things that keep convention in place and create radically there in that vacuum. And I think that was for a lot of people sort of a non-consensual journey. But it was at that same period of time that I was doing all my Saturn devotional work. And that is where I came to love him so deeply as sure the jail warden, but also the one who sneaks you out, right? Who like covers for you when it's time for you to break free. And you've actually learned the reasons why you are where you are in that moment, and you're ready to move on from those without returning, right? Without the like kind of the personal will and boundaries recidivism we can see when someone hasn't metabolized thoroughly their Saturn transit or their Saturn experience. So I love him for that. And I am happy to no longer sit with him every day. I spent the last year with Venus, and it has been a very nice change. But there are moments, right, when you're like very in it with Venus too, where you're like, "Ooh, gotta! I should like get a little bit more of that Saturn bag. Things are getting a little too hot in here, you know." And so I know he is always there when I need him, whether or not I want to need him.
And I think that entire COVID period saw a great deal of transformation in people, and having to be so close in proximity to all of those things that you just mentioned, transformation and death and isolation, creation in the vacuum, those were all things that we collectively had to come to terms with in some way or other. And I think that you would be really hard pressed to find somebody who hadn't been, deeply affected by the events of that period of time. And like magically and even astrologically speaking, I think it was, it was a trial that we had to endure to one level or other, and many of us were changed by it forever. Could you say anything about how you practically engage with Saturn as the threshold guardian of the gateway between the planets and the fixed stars?
At this point, I have tried to reduce my as I was just saying, amount of engagement with Saturn. But whenever, and in particular, when I am opening up conversation with a new constellation, star, deep space object, etc., I always quote unquote pour one out for Saturn.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Right? Recognizing him as the gatekeeper, as the one highest up in the firmament, as the one closest to the stars, as the one that waits at the top of this planetary pyramid, essentially saying, like, you must metabolize, you must acknowledge, you must make good with all of us, right? Before you even begin to encounter what is out there, because it is much less human, it is much less verbal in the ways you're used to speaking, right? That anything you've encountered before in that sublunar and any of the more anthropomorphic forms of the planetary intelligences as well, right? So I always recognize him as something as of a gatekeeper, as a mediator in that context as well. And I will call to him as such before I address particular constellations and stars, essentially saying, I recognize your role here. And also, as someone who did have a very intimate and long-term practice with Saturn, to remind him that, like, my best interest here is also that, you know, if this is not a particular firmamental entity or figure that I should be engaging with at this point, keep that gate locked, buddy. You know, don't let it happen. I'm not always the best judge of what I should or shouldn't be doing. I trust him. He can see much better than me. So I give him little offerings toward that end as well. And, you know, knock on wood, so far, so good.
Okay, all right, that's good. So would you describe your relationship with Saturn maybe in a similar way that more other magicians maybe have a relationship with the moon as the gateway to the stars?
Yeah, as a mediator.
As an intermediary between the planet
Yeah.
and the stars themselves.
Yeah, sure. With that which constellates the light, right, and brings it down, Yes and no. Yes, and I would say I also have a very strong relationship with the moon, but I have a very different experience with the moon than most people in the astrological world tend to engage with her. I come from, again, a much more witchcraft informed experience where the moon is like straight up a vampire, right? And that is also informed by some of my cultural folklore that looks at her as such, but also in my personal experience, the moon, hard. Well, like, there are people that are able to have, you know, bless all my friends with those like lovely third house or ninth house or 10th house, like Taurus moons that really just have this nurturing kind of relationship with the moon. There's a nurturance there, but it is a very shadowy, very consuming, very haunted one in my experience. So the moon is there often whether or not I want her to be. When I want to engage with particular stars or constellations in very particular ways, I am absolutely adamant that she be per se like conjunct the projected ecliptic degree. But when I am not trying to then deal, when I'm not trying to then deal with the added gaze of her, when especially in particular phases or states, I go to the stars outside. And then most witchcraft traditions will reiterate consistently that the idea that one needs a planetary intermediary to have a conversation with or a relationship with particular stars or constellations, right, is very much just a astrological magic conversation. In witchcraft, you need to be able to talk to, communicate with, call down the stars at any point, even if they are not even visible, right? Even if they're below the ecliptic, even if they're below the horizon. Even, you know, we have the luxury of certain circumpolar stars that never set, that are always there, right? And, you know, if you have the benefit of any night sky visibility, you can usually pick out a few of them, right? Whether that's something very bright like Polaris. But still, I mean, Cassiopeia has been super bright lately too. But the idea with the moon is that things take, then you are also working with the moon, right? And that's not something that everyone finds healthy for them.
But there's a specific chthonic aspect, I think, of calling on stars that are underneath the ecliptic.
Yes. And also, no. So yes and no, right? Like totally, absolutely. There's an underworld element there for sure. And I think it's very easy to also see it as a phonic terrestrial thing. And that is not necessarily, I mean, there are certain very phonic terrestrial feeling constellations, Scorpius actually being one of them. While there's a lot of the weird deep space feeling there, of course, many times when I am in that space with those spirits working with clients, it feels like crawling through blood-soaked soil, right? Or like there's a feeling of like, I am not in a place of anti-gravity right now. Like I am immersed in viscera, in something material. But I find that the constellations and stars below the ecliptic feel very much like they are underwater to me. And that particular type of phonic, right? With considering the ocean as like the biggest cemetery on Earth, or considering the ocean as the access point that allows us contact with the stars too, right? We got the celestial sea above and we've got our own sublunar sea as well. And I often think about them, but I'm also a person for whom water plays a really big part of their practice.
Yes, there is so much to say about this subject. Water is such an important topic, and it's of real importance to just about any magical practice. I wish that we could talk about this more, but I'm going to have to press on because there's this paragraph from your pamphlet that I absolutely adore, and I'm going to have to quote it. It is imperative that we remember that the majority of emic folkloric and practical magical applications for the stars we currently associate with misfortune, malefica, and curses has been misappropriated through the meat grinder of Orientalism, colonizing anthropology, and the abominable translations of many European and Anglican grimoires. Lost are many of the stories which revivified the stars and bound them to the terrestrial hearts of the people gazing upon them. Instead, they became servitors enslaved in stones and miscellany, weaponized for their power, for afflicting an enemy or compelling a lover to fell competition or to secure riches and fame. When we lose the folklore, the observational devotion, the worshipping of the stories the stars are telling about themselves, we lose the nuance, we lose the wisdom, we lose the cleverness of their sidereal tongues. Could you elaborate further on what you think has been lost, specifically how the modern witch or sorcerer can reclaim this ancient wisdom?
Totally. I think part of it is recognizing that it was only lost to certain people, right? It has only truly been lost to the translators, to the transliterators, to the interpolators of these original materials. In many cultures across the world, star lore is a living oral lore and tradition, right? And many anthropologists actually have done a really good job from a folk astronomy perspective of preserving many more of these sort of stories than we see in any of the grimoire traditions, right? This is a conversation I have quite frequently with my bestie, J.M. Hamari, who did a lot of translation and illustration work for the Shams al-Marif, about how, in particular, Western European people tend to think they have discovered these precious ancient artifacts of knowledge, right? Without recognizing that a lot of this stuff was not a high ceremony, was not this deeply esoteric sorcery, but practical, daily, very relatively mundane acts of operant magic, right? That got things done and involved a certain level of relationship with the numinous that had to be, by the very nature of the culture, something that was maybe even still clandestine, but was deeply intimate. And we've lost a lot of that intimacy that hasn't turned stars into objects in particular. I love talismans, right? And I often collaborate on rites for my geniusly talented talismanic stellar witch friend, Jeannie of Tides of Tethys. But there's so much more to the practice, right, than most people think when they think the goal is to make them this particular talent, like a Regulus talisman that's going to give them fame, right? These things, the nuance, what it means to be awash in, filled up with, transformed and changed by in your own body as the stone, as the vessel, right? By the stellar light, to feel Regulus's heart pounding in your own chest, not because you have a particular item or materia, but because you have lost yourself in an ecstatic experience of presence, of sorcery, right, with that particular entity is a whole different game, right? And that's the thing that you don't see as much discussed in, and again, I am not making any sweeping claims about how it doesn't happen, right? It's just saying it is not a popularly discussed or explored, like there's always an end goal that isn't just about, my God, I feel so much closer to this spirit, right? Oftentimes it is, oh, I am so much closer to a goal I have because I have a spirit inside of an object. And that, I think, is part of the nuance that gets lost in the translation, is that for many people, this was a worshipful, awful relationship These were gods. The audacity of trying to, I mean, a witch will always be audacious, a witch will always see power and try and claim it in some way, right? But the audacity of wanting to sometimes, I mean, you have to have a certain amount of gall to be like, yeah, I see that weird beaming light god in the sky. I think I wanted to help me get a job, you know? And I think some of the nuance is lost within the milieu of astrological magicians who have lost some of the perhaps more animistic lens of relationship there. And now every interaction you have with these entities in outer space should, if done correctly, change you literally more into their image, not just because you're wearing a piece of jewelry and when you take it off, it goes away, right? That's, in my experience, not the nature of Starlight. Not the the relationship one has with Starfire. It changes you the way the Cenobites get changed, right? It restitches your flesh into new patterns. It patterns the flesh by new stitches, and it creates it in this ever-evolving fashion that is torturous, but it's exquisite, and it's unlike anything else. Obviously, I'm still doing it, even when it's painful. But that nuance is something that has not been lost to many non-Western European peoples the way it has by virtue of a lot of poor translations interested in. And this is not about any contemporary translators, too. These are like the original, ways in which people are writing from the Eddic lens. They're outside of the culture, writing about the things they're witnessing within a culture that, of course, they're never going to have the full story of.
Yes, it's become more about people just trying to acquire something. It's not so much even as transactional as much as what can I get immediately from this thing.
Totally.
Without any of the devotional, without any of the, throwing yourself into becoming part of the practice. Yeah, I see where you're coming from entirely. And I agree with you entirely. It's something that is missing from the way that we are engaging with magic in general. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That was wonderful.
My pleasure.
In your pamphlet, you discuss how specific regions of the sky are host to particular forms of animal intelligence. In this specific case, not only the scorpion, but also a form of arachnid consciousness, which permeated your work concerning the fixed stars of Scorpius. You write, "They were hungry and suspicious maidens who crawled out from the forgotten crevices of time and space, suspending themselves down their star ladders made of weaver's silk."
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
To cross the threshold of dream and nightmare alike, what other forms of animal or insect intelligence have you encountered?
Oh, man. I love this question. And it's almost so much comes to mind so immediately, because this has been probably one of my greatest areas of obsession in my work, is sort of mental mapping the sky for the weird figures that seem to dwell within it, right? You have everything from the swan maidens and the goose knights of the constellation Cygnus, to the carrion vultures and the weird flaming dark-winged bat creatures of like Vega. You have the headless horsemen and the other type of centaur-like creatures that are often not just horse-bodied but can be deer-bodied or moose-bodied that you find within Centaurus. I mean, one of the favorite is the connection. Both Acubens and Cancer, as well as Arcturus, have very strong mantis-related connections in my experience. You have, so many different types of weird serpentine creatures that are always writhing in the many stellar nests of the firmament as well. I have found with every constellation that I have, I mean, and again, I have worked with a lot of constellations, and each of them tend to have a lot of diversity, but again, recurring patterns. So some of the what I named are just a few of the ones that we found. I mean, some of the most interesting to engage with are these, like, sometimes roughly humanoid, but very like angler fishy looking folks from Cetus in particular. Incredibly interesting constellation, because you also then have the viperfish shark kind of faces with the double, like, the jaws that inspired Giger's xenomorphs, right? Where there's the smaller jaw within the larger jaw that is able to spring forward. There's real creatures in the bottom of the ocean that have that same technology with their mouth. And I think that was a big point of his. Anyway, that's a got excited talking about the Alien franchise again. Big surprise. But there's such a tremendous range. I mean, the water horses and the jellyfish of Sualosin, the crane wives of Alcyon. It just goes on and on. There's all over. And my biggest joy every day that I sit with a client is getting to discover something more, something interesting there. Yeah, that's some that it creates an unending sense of almost like novelty, while at the same time showing the really tremendous lace work of patterning that even the weirdest areas of space seem to reflect.
It's wonderful because it's like this this huge ecology that you're describing.
Yes, absolutely. That's what it feels like. I feel like I'm in Jurassic Park or something, and I'm going to these different environment, different habitats, right? I mean, like, luckily the fence is usually still working for me, but I still have the pleasure of getting to travel around and observe these spirits in their local territories from a respectful distance, and speak with them when I need to on behalf of clients. Usually with a spirit of my own liaising between us, but yeah, it is a spectacular privilege, and it never loses any of its shine, any of its dynamism.
So later in your pamphlet, you write, the poison is the medicine, the curse is also the cure. I think many of our listeners will understand that whatever a spirit can give, they can also take away, which hugely broadens the offices of the spirits that we engage with. How then can we engage with these spirits in regard to, say, our astrological birth chart to discover the spirits that were present at the time, and how can we learn to engage with them?
This question is a lot of the work that I do with my clients, right? Is using a system that I have created through doing this work with over 1,000 charts at this point, to scry the stellar spirits available, to narrow down to the most beneficial and useful tutelary ones amongst them, and then communicating with those spirits with the client present on how to begin developing at first a slowly rapport and relationship building kind of dynamic. This becomes interesting and challenging, because what you'll notice with many stellar spirits is that they just don't speak, right? It is a very profound, delightful privilege a lot of the times, right? That we're used to spirits that will communicate with us in ways that we are used to communicating. But the idea of a verbal human language is not interesting and is beneath many deep space or stellar spirits who see it as like a testament to how feeble and easily overwhelmed our minds are at perceiving, right, that we need something like this lattice work of language in order to communicate. So a lot of my work ends up being to identifying how this individual, the native, can communicate with these spirits that are nonverbal, quote unquote, right? And a lot of that has to do with me sitting there with them and coaching them through recognizing different bodily sensations. Does it recur? Like this spirit is saying, it shows up with this particular physical sensation, and they'll be like, oh my God, I've always wondered what that particular sensation is, because it always comes out of nowhere and always at this weird moment, right? We kind of trace these clues back to each other. So how can someone begin to do this on their own, right? Independent of a session with me? I'm training a bunch of people right now in my technique, so there'll be more people who can have use of it and then build and extrapolate on their own. But if someone has a scrying practice with relative success, you could very easily go to, I'll just at some point publicize my technique so people can use it independently. I often recommend that people work with stars that were present on the angles of the nativity at the moment of their birth, and you can pull up for free on astro.com under the extended chart section. If you go to the second tab, when you pull up a chart, you can put Perrins by Burdonette Brady into the drop down box. And if you see stars on the natal horizon or meridian at the moment, that's usually where I start, and I would recommend scrying with them. Or stars that are in the lower culmination, which is the hearthstone stars, quote unquote, according to her, that are culminating with Venus in particular. Those are where I recommend for identifying which spirits walk with you in almost a... Or which locale of particular stellar spirit is going to walk with you in a way that is supportive, that is tutelary, that is beneficial to your growth. They have some pacted from the moment of your birth interest in making sure that you do what you need to do and get where you need to get, right? Which is not by and large true in totality of the other stars that we have natal parent relationships with throughout different phases of our life. So one could scry there. It helps, and I say this with like a tenderness for my fellow lovers of folkloric witchcrafts. One cannot do this work if they are rooted in a certain kind of neophobia. Stellar witchcraft is as much chrome and neon as it is dirt and trees, right? And that is a real, like, I am not interested in us only looking to the past to substantiate a practice. I'm very interested in where we're going, what's going to be there when we get there, and working with materials that shows some longevity. So yeah, that means that AI can be a part of this, right? Yeah, that means that computers and technology absolutely need to be a part of this. Yeah, I think that your interest in astronomy is probably at this point a little bit more important than most of the interests that we're going to have in occulted astrological texts, right? We're going to need both. We're going to need what is ahead of us in the trajectory that we're going through in this era of age that we've entered into recently as an astrological cycle. And if we are too busy looking at what we have deemed valuable because it worked in the past, we're going to get left behind. So in order to do this work, to be able to see these kind of spirits and work with them, you have to be able to really open up your levels of perception to different things than what you might be used to seeing working within a folkloric witchcraft context, right? Things that do look uncanny and eldritch and alien and are as much there to work with you, and especially the Arcturus spirits, have so much personal vested ulterior motives, right, in human interaction, that as any, you know, Robin artisan, elf knight, you know, petitioning, anything that you read in any text, right, any of these famous daemons, demons, elves, fairies, etc. There's really more in common between them. And there's more discourse and discussion between them than there usually is with us and what else is out there. So not being afraid of that is a big place of entryway into you actually being in a position to engage intentionally in relationship with those spirits that you do have natal relationships with already, because they're waiting, but you have to be willing to see them.
Yeah, you have to be able to summon the courage to do it in the first place.
Totally. Right? The worst thing we can do to impair our ability to perceive a spirit is to have an expectation of what it's going to look like, you know, how it's going to communicate, etc.
Sasha, are you working on writing about other regions of the sky? I think a book on this subject would be really well received.
Yeah, I have a book that I'm working on right now with Meg that I mentioned earlier, which is specifically the Hydran Stellar Witchcraft Current. So this is it's going to be more monograph form. We had like really humble expectations for where we were beginning, but we are both generously long-winded, and so it is growing in size. But that will be a really deep dive into constellation Hydra. And that particular current of stellar witchcraft beneath and through her particular initiatory tract. And there's just no other, as far as I'm aware, book of its kind out there. And I also have it's already signed a contract, but it's a longer term project, which is my personal grimoire of all of my stellar witchcraft workings, constellating all of the stars and constellations that I have found particularly relevant in a witchcraft context, because again, not all of them need to be used that way, organized in their four respective kingdoms with their respective banners and kings and queens. And I've had some jokes from people that it feels a little bit like some of the Goetia in space. But yeah, I mean, that wouldn't be entirely wrong. We again still rely upon the tools we have for organizing things too. And that has different initiatory rites, invocational rites, and it's along the pillars again of Hydra and Ophiuchus. So the serpentess, the queen cobra, and the serpent charmer in the sky. And that'll come out when it's ready. The thing about that work is you kind of have to wait till they're like, okay, it's our month, it's our turn, here, now you get to know this thing and do this thing.
Just describing it as Goetia in space, you've already sold a copy to me, so.
Okay, yeah. Maybe it's the title now too. It's kind of sketchy, huh?
All right, and where can people find you online, Sasha?
Oh boy, where can't they find me online? Your girl is chronically online. So my Instagram is at sasha.ravitch. My Twitter is, that I'm not on that much anymore, is at Sasha Ravitch, no dot. My Patreon with my really incredible Patreon Discord community of over 250 profoundly fucking smart, wonderful, oops, I don't know if I was supposed to swear, wonderful researchers, witches, astrologers, all kinds of good stuff, is patreon.com/SashaRavitch. And I feel like I'm forgetting something. Oh yeah, my email is sasha.ravitch@gmail.com. Okay, and this is going to be crazy because you will not have noticed a trend so far, but my website is sasharavitch.com. So if you put my name in there, a bunch of stuff is going to inevitably come up. And if you just go to the Instagram, you can find most of the other things through that on the link tree in my bio.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Sasha, for coming on today. It's been really wonderful talking to you and learning about this very interesting branch of magic that you've been pioneering. And I'm looking forward to speaking to you again in the future.
It was such a pleasure, Matt. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
That was Sasha Ravitch discussing some of the elements of her phenomenal guide to the underworld, The Red Dreaded Spindle, an astrologer's guide to the stinger stars of Scorpius. What an amazing conversation. I'm really interested in this particular exploration of stellar magic, and I loved all of the many insights that Sasha had to offer on the specifics of how she personally engages not only planetary spirits as threshold guardians, intermediaries, and tutelaries, but also in concepts such as metabolizing stellar forces within the flesh so that they can find their expressions in our lives. I'm also fascinated by the potential of exploration of a stellar ecology and all of the implications that that brings. Sasha is spearheading something novel and honestly refreshing, as well as pioneering, which I really hope will gain more traction in the future, engaging in the mythic via alternative means through blood and viscera and the dirt, as well as through initiation into the mysteries of the stars in the depths of space, through and beyond the fixed stars. I think that there's a lot for us to all contemplate here, especially if you are interested in beginning your own exploration into these fascinating regions of the night sky, and I'm really looking forward to talking to Sasha again in the future. You will find links to all of Sasha's contact points in the description below. Please subscribe, like, comment, and share this video if you can. Every little bit helps not only the channel, but also all of the authors at Hadean Press, as we intend to promote their amazing work. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation with Sasha and I, and I look forward to seeing you all in the next one.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.